this size with this many moving parts, but on balance, the environment and water quality was protected. Just as evidence of that, again, you know, the prosecution team had two hours here. They used, by my count, roughly a quarter of that talking about emails and letters that relate to a completely different time frame. You know, during Mr. Cohen's tenure on this project, there was in most cases a month or a year after the time frame covered by this complaint. So I think that that's been the general approach here, is that we're going to have this myopic little view of what exactly happened here. We're going to cherry pick the facts that work for us and support our view of this, and we're going to ignore the large body of information that shows things were done right. The interpretation of the project requirements deserves a little bit of mention. In settlement discussions throughout this proceeding, the prosecution team has been fairly strident that the certification requirements are just clear as day. I mean, they're in black and white right there on the paper. I mean, how could you not know what they say? How could you not know what they mean? I think what we've seen today is that's not the case at all. Mr. Cohen explained that he had a lot of difficulty personally, you know, being someone who's you know, an expert in these sort of things, who's accustomed to SWIP requirements, understanding exactly what the certification meant and what Caltrans and the contractors had to do. MCM obviously had similar issues. And the testimony that we received is that the regional board wasn't doing much to help, and that they, even within the regional board staff, reportedly, there were disagreements about what particular requirements meant, and also that there was a change over time in what you know, one particular provision meant from one year to the next. And so that obviously leaves, you know, Caltrans, and it leaves MCM, and it leaves other contractors in a bit of a lurch as far as what they're supposed to do. And I think the way MCM approached it here was the appropriate way. You know, we went through our presentation, and the way we structured it was intentional. For each one of these categories of violation, the question is, what is the BMP? You know, what's the specific requirement that we're supposed to be following? And did we follow that? For example, maintenance is required. And there's two BMPs, one in the certification and one actually in Caltrans, you know, standard specs that requires, you know, certain types of maintenance. We did that. We did that in spades. In fact, we went above and beyond what was required. We went throughout our presentation, and I know it was laborious, you know, checking off all of those. So I think the evidence shows that the MCM, you know, responded and tried to pick their way through this, you know, ambiguity about as carefully and as reasonably as anyone could. Next, the construction process. Again, thank you for you know, helping sift through that. There was a lot of information. And I hope it was helpful. I think what came through with all of that is that MCM and Caltrans actually did a good job on this project. And the evidence of that is the fact that we don't have any injury. You know, as I said at the beginning, the application in this case specifically allowed certain types of temporary impacts from turbidity, from sedimentation. And that's natural because in this type of a project, you couldn't have had otherwise. You can't build a bridge, much less two major bridges in a waterway, without having these sort of impacts. So comparing the information in the record on what sort of impacts occurred with what we actually had in the application, we found not only they were consistent with what was contemplated, but they were actually less. And we went through towards the end of the things that MCM and Caltrans did to avoid impacts that were actually permitted by the project. You know, for example, we had that big ramp that we could have built that would have essentially nuked the hillside, right? We had other low water crossings we could have put in place. We had a number of other things that we could have done, including, you know, up to 50-plus different pilings in the river that we avoided by doing the project better in a ways that enhanced and protected water quality. So what sort of message would it send if you know, we hammer on Caltrans and hammer on MCM for doing the job that you would hope a contractor would do in a situation like this? You know, when a contractor goes out of their way to design and make changes on a project that actually make it a less impactful project, that actually help the environment to avoid impacts, I think what we do if we're an agency responsible for protecting water quality is we recognize that in some way. We don't pick through the record, you know, focus on these little tiny things, and then blow them up as much as we can to make for the fattest possible administrative civil liability, and I do think that's what's been done here. Also, the standard of care. We had two experts in this case, Dave Melendez and David Bieber, testified that Caltrans and the MCM adhered to standard of care for construction practices and followed the best management practices required under Caltrans specs and under the certification. We have no contrary expert evidence on that point from the regional board. What we have is the prosecution team's interpretation of what certain, you know, conditions of the certification mean. Interpretations that, as we've noted, are a little bit shifting, have changed over time, weren't very firm, and didn't give the contractors at Caltrans very much guidance. The adequacy of the evidence also is a major issue in this case. We have a seriously confused record, and the reason for that is pretty clear, because we don't have a situation where the prosecution team went out and actually interviewed people. They didn't perform what would normally consider a proper investigation. What they did is basically pull together all the project logs and just sort through them and just, you know, exhaustively look through them, looking for problems, looking for things that might have been done wrong. In most cases, those weren't established. The most I think we can say of most of those, you know, violations is that there are situations that probably deserve a little more inquiry, that probably would merit someone, you know, asking, hey, you know, what happened in this situation? MCM, let's have an interview. What happened here? Caltrans, let's have an interview. What happened? Those things didn't happen. I want to comment briefly on the settlement discussions. We did spend some time here with the prosecution team trying to work our way to a settlement. I wasn't going to bring those up because I don't think it was very helpful to do that. Since it's been raised, in closing, I'll just make a quick comment. My own impression is that the approach of the prosecution team was definitely shoot first and ask questions later. You know, we see that the way the complaint came down. You know, MCM had no notice whatsoever that there was going to be an ACL complaint in the range of, you know, $1 to $2 million. It wasn't until that complaint was filed that anyone actually engaged us to ask what had happened. And then no one really asked, right? There was a little bit of settlement back and forth, but frankly, it was kind of like, you know, these are clear requirements. You didn't follow them. You know, you need to be hammered. And that was pretty much where it left. And if that's the situation, of course, we're going to go to hearing as we've done. On the slate, what MCM believes are the violations that are disputed and undisputed is on the March 22nd, 2011 slate that's been provided to the regional board. And that was submitted at the advisory team's request. Some comment was made about the fact that changed from what we'd said before. The truth is that every party, including the prosecution team in this proceeding, has modified its slate of allegations and disputed allegations. You know, as our understanding of what's happened in this case has deepened, you know, as information has come out, as depositions have been taken. And that's what ours has done as well. And so our most up-to-date and what we believe is the right and accurate slate is before you guys, dated March 22nd. Finally, on section 13385, a couple of issues that we raised. Again, we believe these are fatal flaws to the complaint. You know, one is the fact that there is no individualized analysis of the 13385E factors for any of these claims. You know, we have hundreds of claims. I know it would be burdensome. I know it would be time-consuming. But I think that's what the law requires. You know, my own experience with other regional boards is that they have a practice, they have a you know, methods for actually applying those factors individually to violations. You know, clearly that wasn't done here. And that was just a part of this process, a necessary part, that was just skipped over. Understand it's difficult and laborious, but it needed to be done. And finally, for the issue of double counting, I first just want to, you know, use an example here. Category AA or Category A, construction dewatering violations. You know, those are mostly the isolated pool B. There's many violations, you know, collected under that category. In most cases, there are three different conditions of the violations that are considered violated. And, with maximum potential civil liability up to $30,000 and a proposal of a liability for that category for, I believe, $390,000. So first, let's just put that in perspective. Isolated Pool B, a lot of talk about it, but, certain things have come out. First of all, it was as far away from the river as you could put it. There was a lot of discussion, a lot of consideration about where this should go and how best to comply with the application. And I think the contractors on the job and Caltrans did as good of a job as they could have, given the situation. It certainly wasn't a situation where anyone was wantonly avoiding the requirements of the certification. Beyond that, we've received testimony that it didn't really matter this difference between 70 and 100 feet. The point was is to have an effective best management practice, to have an effectively functioning sedimentation basin. The evidence was is that it did. Mr. Bieber explained that. He said the difference between 70 feet and 100 feet, particularly where this basin is located, considering the morphology of the river, there was probably at least 100 feet of filtration in reality that you gain from where that particular basin was located. And then we also heard, we noted testimony received from Mr. Pratt, the fact that difference between 70 feet and 100 feet, if he had that information at the time he wrote the certification, it wouldn't have been a big deal, and he would have permitted 70 feet. So there's really, I don't want to make it sound like it's a lot of do about nothing, but it kind of is. This isn't a major issue. And we now are facing, civil liability of, $300,000 to $400,000 based on it. So something right there is a little bit skewed, and it's not quite right. But let me get to the 13385 issue. I'll just take one of these, and we have a violation of pumping into isolated pool B, violates condition 9 and condition 17. Condition 9 is a fairly broad violation, no debris, soil, silt, et cetera, other than authorized by this permit shall be allowed to enter into waters of the state. And we have 17, which I consider kind of the catch-all provision here. All activities, BMPs, shall be conducted as described in the permit and the application. We have two very broad conditions here. And virtually any time a particular event is going to violate any condition of the certification, it's also going to violate 17. And so what the prosecution has done here is essentially, tack on 17 to all of these other, violations that are already covered by other conditions of the certification. I don't think that's what was intended under the Water Code. I think that's what's expressly prohibited under the Water Code, and I don't think that's what federal law or state law permits, this sort of stacking of violations based on the same set of facts. Anyway, we've already submitted a briefing on it, so I won't labor the point anymore. I would just close by asking that the regional board members look at this critically. I think that when you do, you'll find that MCM and Caltrans did a good job in this project, and I think that should be recognized. Thank you.
Thank you.
Do we have any concluding comments from board members or panelists?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Noren?
I,